Welcome to another edition of She Persisted here on the Progressive Voices Network. My name is Melissa Carter, and I'm mourning the loss of the Litchfield women. I binged watched Orange is the New Black, finally finished the whole thing, and am sad. Now, I know there's a lot of people who didn't make it through all six seasons. I know several friends who dropped out. I'm the same way about shows like Game of Thrones and some of those I dropped out a long time ago. I probably will come back for the last season of Game of Thrones, though. But I was every episode of Orange is the New Black. Loved that show. And it's, I just think it was such a brilliant show. Beautifully written. Because, I mean, think about it. You had all these characters that they were able to write stories about, and you be able to keep up with each one of them and keep up with the stories of them interacting with each other and not get confused. Like, that's good writing. When you can incorporate all that information, keep it flowing for 6 years, whether some of the stories were kind of lame or not, but still the fact that it carried through. I don't know. I just thought it was a brilliant show. And so I actually ordered the book because I didn't want to read Orange is the New Black. I didn't read the book before the show. And if you didn't know, it's based on a book, based on a true story of Piper. But I didn't want to read it because the book is a little different than what they did with the TV show, as it always is. But like in the book, in real life, she was only there for 15 months in minimum security. And she didn't end up with her former lover in the book. A little disappointing because I really enjoyed Piper and Alex. But anyway, so, you know, when you have a TV show that you love so much and it ends, there is a mourning process. You really become attached to those people, those characters. And it's just, oh, the loss of this. And just you just think about it and you think about the characters, think about the show, and then you just move on to something else. So now I've got to move on to another show. I have not found it yet. But yeah, stuck with that for a long time. And now it's time to say goodbye. So sad. So Mr. Carter's aunt, my sister, is in contention for buying the coolest gift for Mr. Carter. She had texted me and said, expect something in the mail. And it's for Mr. Carter, and you need batteries. And then she sent me text updates on how many batteries I need. Well, you need AA. No, you need AAA. You need four of them. No, you need eight of them. And so I wrote back and I said, no problem. I'm used to little kid toys needing all kinds of batteries, and so I've got plenty of them. And I tell you, a great tool to help you keep up with how many batteries you have in the house, years ago, and I forgot what catalog it was I got in the mail, but I ordered a battery holder that hangs in my laundry room. And Katie used to make fun of it when she lived with me, but it is basically a little holder where you put the batteries in the slots, and it has a battery. It's not a charger, but it's a tester. So it's one of those like things that it just hang on the wall and you just slip all the batteries in there, and it takes 8 volt plus, I mean, the D batteries and C's and AA's and AAA. I mean, it's the coolest thing. And so you can visually see from that battery holder how many batteries you've got and if you need to buy more. And so I had plenty of AAA batteries for whatever my sister was going to send in the mail. So I finally got the box, opened it up, and in the box was some walkie-talkies. Now, I had thought about getting Mr. Carter some walkie-talkies, but I had not pulled the trigger on it. They were like in my wish list on Amazon, and I basically use my wish list and my card on Amazon. I'm not endorsing, just telling you my life, to kind of as my to-do list. That's a great place for me. Even if I don't buy it from them, I put it there just to remind me. So I had some walkie-talkies in my cart, never purchased them, and I was so excited when she sent those walkie-talkies. Got the batteries, put them in the walkie-talkies, and Mr. Carter, when I gave them to him, I just had to tell him one time how to use it. And he was obsessed the rest of the night. So I even taught him about feedback, because if you put the walkie-talkies together too closely and you press the talk button, it's going to give you feedback. And so I taught him feedback, because in broadcasting, I mean, it's a common thing that you have to deal with. He knows what feedback is. My sister had told me that she had done that in hopes that I would be able to go to the bathroom by myself again. And it's worked once or twice where he's been satisfied enough to hear me on the walkie-talkie. He doesn't have to see me. Because at three, he's at the age where he still wants to see me every second of the of his time with me. So it doesn't matter if we're in the house, wherever we are, in the car. Like, he doesn't like me to come to get him out of the car from the back of the car. He wants me to come around the front of the car so he can see me through the windshield. He wants his eye on me all the time. A couple times I've been able to pee by myself for the first time in a long time when I have him. So, but it's just the funnest. It's the funnest toy for him. And I love the fact, and even when we're together, like if we're in the bedroom laying watching a movie or something, like I try to hold it kind of like to my side so my body is blocking the two so feedback doesn't happen. But he wants to talk side by side with them. He loves these things. But one of the issues I've had with it on certain days is that certain channels won't work. So it is toy walkie-talkies, but it does have a series of channels on it, and you can scan channels. And so the first couple days we used it, we were on a channel and everything was fine. And then, for some reason, one of the walkie-talkies won't work on a channel. And it may be something I'm doing, but I found that the past couple times we've played with them, I've had to scan the channels. So the other night, he was a little disappointed because we couldn't get it to work. And so I was scanning channels, and then we heard a woman talk. And it's not surprising because I grew up with CBs as well as walkie-talkies. And if you're on these devices that scan these, you know, non-private channels, then you're going to hear somebody else. He was kind of freaked out by that because he was looking at me. I wasn't talking. He wasn't talking. And a woman's voice was coming over the walkie-talkie. And he like put his hands over his ears and said, "Make her stop. Make her stop." So I think that night I scanned channels and she was over a bunch of channels. So I just turned it off. However, when I tried again to turn it back on, she was still on. I took the walkie-talkie to the kitchen and Mr. Carter was in the living room. And I didn't want him to be disturbed by her, but I was trying to find a channel where we could talk without this interruption, this intrusion into our private space. And then I noticed the woman, I mean, it's as if she was, I don't know, she started off the conversation talking about bringing a kid over or whatever. So I thought she was talking to a friend. So it ends up like she wasn't talking to a child. She was talking to another adult who obviously was not in her house. And so I listened because I'm thinking, well, you're on the walkie-talkie, so I'm going to listen to what you're having to say. And so I captured a little of it because this is how her conversation evolved.
Good stuff for sure. You'll have to drag that booster seat over here when you bring them over here for Tango Tuesday or something of that nature. So, well, Shannon, I'm going to go ahead and move on. So make sure you stick around for when we open up the floor. That will bring me to Atlanta 131. Morgan in Cleveland. Good evening, Morgan. How is everything going on over there, my friend?
She's doing a fucking show. Like, it's like the walkie-talkie show. I never considered doing a broadcast show on my walkie-talkie. I mean, she's taking requests. Like, I mean, what? I turned it off after that to go back to Mr. Carter. But I'm like, is she a professional? Like, what? I never thought of this as a format for a show. And how many listeners does she have? Who is she talking to? Does she have a request line? Like, she was finishing talking to somebody and then went on to somebody else. I was fascinated. Now, is this a case where, maybe does she not have a walkie-talkie? Am I picking up a different type of, like, ham radio something? I mean, my brother did the ham radio thing. I didn't do it. It was cool because ham radio, you can listen to shows across the world. But it's like, so she's like, she's a host on my walkie-talkie. How bizarre. Just how bizarre. And if you look, if the podcast doesn't work, at least now I know I have another venue I can try.
So make sure you stick around for when we open up the floor.
I have a guest today. her name is Tara Naomi. Now, she may be somebody that you're familiar with because it was back in the day when she was the first musician to go viral and get a record deal from YouTube. There were so many people who made covers of this song.
I see the lights are turning and I look outside. The stars are burning through this changing time. It could have been anything we want. It's fine, salvation was just a passing.
She won the first YouTube award for music. She was signed to Universal Island Records. She even played Wembley Stadium in England. I mean, and that's almost 100,000 people. Some like 80,000 people she played in front of. Now she is releasing new music, and she is joining She Persisted to talk about it. And if you are in the Atlanta area, which I know a lot of She Persisted listeners are, she's coming to town, and you can see her. Please welcome Tara Naomi. I have a 3-year-old son, and I've mentioned on the show before that his main form of entertainment is YouTube. Like, there are, I think there's a lot of people who don't realize that there are very sophisticated children's programming going on YouTube with people who don't even bother to do anything on mainstream media. Now, a couple of the things that we've seen on YouTube have actually made it to Netflix. His main source of entertainment is YouTube, and it's not even children's programming. Like, he is a huge fan of trains, so he just wants to see videos of people that have gone out in the yard and taking pictures of trains going down the track. So now you obviously are very familiar with the fact that YouTube is a very powerful tool. So do you mind talking a little bit about, I mean, YouTube's been around now for a while, but when you started, it was brand new. So talk a little bit about why you even chose YouTube as a platform.
Sure. It was really early days. I think I posted one thing. I was doing a lot on MySpace. And MySpace was huge at the time. And it was great for music. They had a whole MySpace music, and it was a good music discovery platform. I heard sort of simultaneously from a couple different people, and I think it was like on the same day even, one of my brothers and then another friend, they were like, you really should check out YouTube. And I was like, all right, I'll check it out. You know, I looked at it, and I'm like, yeah, that's cool, I guess, you know, people making videos. And then I looked around and I saw, you know, they were actors kind of creating their own content and personalities and people who seem sort of like hosts. And I'm like, this is so interesting. There was like a little comedy, and there were already millions of videos on there, but not billions and billions or however many are on there now. So I thought, you know, I had been touring a lot in my car, just driving around the country and playing these little gigs. And it was the summer of 2006, and gas prices were at an all-time high. And I think in California, gas was like between $4 and $5 a gallon. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, well, there's just no way that I'm going to be able to afford to do this again. And so then it kind of occurred to me like, oh, wait, what if I just did the videos at home and put them online and different song every day or every other day or whatever. And so I came up with this idea for the virtual summer tour. And I put up a couple covers at first, and then started putting up originals. And then people were, you know, I didn't have a huge audience. I think I had about 1,000 or 2,000 people who would watch the videos that I put up over the course of, you know, it seems like it was such a long time, by the way. It's like, I'm thinking over the course of it, but it was only like a couple weeks.
Right. Right.
You know, like between the time that I started doing this and the time that it, you know, got popular, it wasn't that long, but those periods of time always feel so long, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, especially when you're looking for the results, because the fact that you can see the results on YouTube, an hour seems like it's an eternity.
Yeah. And also like remembering it, looking back on that time, I'm thinking it feels like such a long period of time, but like the entire period of time from like the first YouTube video that I posted for the virtual summer tour and like the end of my whole record deal situation was only a couple of years. So it's pretty funny. It feels like a whole lifetime happened during that time. So I started putting these videos up, and then people would write messages and they started asking questions, and they were curious, you know, because here's this person who's putting up videos and talking, you know, I would talk sometimes, just say a couple things about what I was doing or what my life was like as this sort of unknown, independent, up and coming, hopefully, musician. So I started this series called Ask a Wannabe Rockstar. And it was just sort of like the funny kind of irreverent title and I would answer people's questions. And that started to get kind of popular. And then I posted the video for Say It's Possible as part of the virtual summer tour. I mean, that's, the story is bizarre. Do you want to hear the real, do you want to hear the whole story?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The more bizarre, the better.
Okay. It's totally weird though. It's like one of these weird, it's one of these weird, like if it hadn't happened to me stories, I wouldn't believe it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'd been doing a lot of yoga at the time. I mean, at the time that I was posting these videos, I'd been in LA for a few years. I was probably $20,000 in credit card debt. I was trying to make it as a singer-songwriter, and I wasn't, you know, I was spending more than I earned, and I had a credit card, and so I was charging everything, and it was getting out of hand. I'd gone out to LA to work with a producer who was kind of like, come here, I'll make you a star, that whole thing.
Right.
And it'd been 3 years, which felt like an eternity, and nothing had happened. And so I really thought, like, wow, this is it for me, you know, in my 20s, being like,
I'm a
has-been,
I'm a wash-up,
yeah,
it didn't
work. It's never going to happen. But, I mean, especially then, at the time, Britney Spears was big, and like, and even now, it's like, you know, the only people getting signed to major label deals, which in 2006 felt like the thing that needed to happen in order to be heard, you know,
right.
It's a much different situation now. But in 2006, it's like the musical landscape. If you weren't a Disney star or like a teenager, people thought you were old.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was not okay. And so it was awful. But so I really was like, wow, you know, I guess this is it for me. And so I was doing a lot of yoga, like trying to keep myself relatively functional and sane. And I was already so much in debt that when the opportunity came up to go on this yoga retreat, I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to charge it. I'm going to do it. And so I got a tent from a friend of mine. I'd never set up a tent before. And I went to this mountain in New Mexico. It was this Kundalini yoga retreat, like on top of a mountain in Española, New Mexico. And so I was on the plane. And at the airport, I picked up a Rolling Stone magazine. And a couple nights before, I had posted my song, Say It's Possible, and I thought it felt like a song that would connect with people. Like sometimes when I write a song, I just know that there's something special about it, you know?
Right.
And this was that, you know, I wrote the song in 15 minutes. It just felt like a download, you know, and that's happened a few other times since then, but this was the first time that had ever happened to me where the whole thing just wrote itself in 15 minutes.
Well, it's such a complex, like the lyrics are so, I mean, it's such a beautiful song. So when I, you know, just to reiterate that 15 minutes that you write it, like you had some spiritual connection with that song. I mean, it's not an easy song. It's not like a fluff song.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's funny because the songs that download never are. It's so funny. It's like the other three that I can think of right offhand that just came like that, really quickly beginning to end, there's three songs on my upcoming album, When You Come Around, For My Last Number, and Machine Age. And all of them, Machine Age is a 6.5 minute protest song that like wrote itself from beginning to end in about 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just wild. It's like the songs that all those songs, I never thought about it that way, but you're right. It's like, it's not like a simple, it's got some complexity, and all the songs that have downloaded like that I can think of right now, they're all similar in that way, that they all kind of, like if I'd tried to write those songs, any of the ones that I just mentioned, I don't think I could have, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. No, I get it.
Not the way they are, you know? It's like, wow, how did I come up with that? I posted Say It's Possible, and I just felt like it was a special song. And so I was on the plane flying to New Mexico feeling like my life was over and I might as well just go blow the rest of my credit on a yoga retreat. And and I was reading, it was like 10:30 in the morning and I was tired, and I was reading Rolling Stone, and there was an article about Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, who are the founders of YouTube. And it was saying how YouTube was emerging as this platform that was creating real careers in the real world, as opposed to just sort of the online personality for actors, for a couple. And I don't know if they called them actors, but they were kind of like personalities. There were a couple of personalities at this point that had broken out and were now becoming presenters in quote unquote legit productions, and signing production deals and stuff. And I thought, oh, this is so interesting. And I was looking at their photos specifically, I was looking at Chad Hurley's photo, and I just had this flash that came into my mind. It was like, if he would just somehow stumble upon my video, I think he would like it. And if he would put it on the front page, because the front page at the time was a big deal,
right?
So it's like, if he would just stumble upon my video and put it on the front page, I really feel like people would connect with this song. And it was a song about climate change, and it was, you know, it was important to me, and it had a message and that I wanted to get out there. And so I was thinking, you know, that was like literally what I thought. And then I fell asleep. And so I remember just sort of falling asleep. And I woke up when the plane landed, got in a van, went up the mountain, was pitching my tent or trying. It was embarrassingly bad at it.
Did you get it up enough to where you could crawl inside and sleep? I mean, because that's more than a lot of people can do.
I did. I ended up only staying for one night. I ended up ditching the whole thing and coming home because it was an intense thing. They would come through the camp and like wake us up at 4 a.m. To do this like meditations. And then like we had to get up and, I mean, it was intense. And then, so and it was freezing, by the way. It was June, mid June. And I thought it was going to be warm, but it was high desert. And so it was absolutely freezing. And then they would make us take cold showers first thing. I mean, it was it's all these rituals having to do with specific to Kundalini yoga and other spiritual practices. They would come through at 4 a.m. and wake us up for sadhana. And then we'd have to take these freezing cold showers at like 6 or something, or maybe it was even 4 before. I can't even remember, but it was intense. And so the fact that all of this happened while I was there and I had to leave early, I was kind of like, oh, that's awful. And also sort of like, thank you.
Right.
You know? Thank you for getting me out of here. So I was up there and I got a text from a very good friend of mine who used to help book my tours and tour with me, and very important figure in my career in general. So she texted me, and I get this text message, and it says, you know, I don't know what's happening, but your MySpace page is blowing up. You've gotten like tens of thousands of plays in the last hour. I don't know where it's coming from. I'm going to look around and try to figure this out. It was like, well, am I on the front page of MySpace? And she's like, no, you're not on the front page of MySpace. And so I thought, okay, well, figure it out and let me know what's going on. And about 10 minutes later, she wrote back and she said, you're not going to believe this, but Say It's Possible is on the front page of YouTube. And that's where all the traffic is coming from, because people are seeing you on there and then going to find more. And my mind was absolutely blown. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't. I mean, it was like, what is happening right now?
I totally understand, because it seems that in everybody's life, regardless of what it is, I mean, sometimes the results are this profound and sometimes they're small. Mm-hmm. But it does seem mm-hmm. that once you give in, you know, almost like give in to the universe, like, okay, I don't know what else I'm supposed to do. And the universe is like, okay, well, let me push you in the direction it's supposed to go. Like, a lot of people will be like that. The fact that magazine that had the article about the founders of YouTube on it happened to be there for you to, you know, read mm-hmm. while you were on the plane. There's really no mm-hmm. coincidences. And it also reminded me of the story of Adam Lambert, because when I was doing morning radio, we had gone out there for American Idol and we had interviewed him. And similar story with him, where he was frustrated in his music career and he went to Burning Man. So it wasn't a yoga camp, mm-hmm. but he went to Burning Man and with the same physical attitude of, you know what, I give up. I'm going to Burning Man. I'm just going to let go. And then whatever life brings after that is what will happen. And then that, and American Idol happened right after that. And you know, now he's with Queen and all that stuff. So
that's amazing.
So I do think that, you know, the older I get, even though when I was younger, I understood and did not dismiss things like that. But I do think that there is a partnership between us and the universe, and that when we try to control too much of our part of the partnership is when we get that, I'm running up against a wall. I have nothing. I have no more choices. I'm just confused on what I'm supposed to be doing. Here you are with all this activity on MySpace and on YouTube. And then it just continues to grow from there.
Yeah, it continued to grow from there. I flew back to LA. I changed my flight. And so sorry, you got to leave the yoga sheet. So upset about this. Bye. And and got back to LA, and it didn't stop. And then next thing I knew, there were people making cover videos of the song. And that was really the most interesting thing to me. It was like, wow, okay, so people are now, and it wasn't just like a couple people, it was dozens of people, and then it was hundreds of people. And it was to the point where people, where I made a video showing people how to play it, because they were like, I want to make a cover video, I want to make, you know, there were that, now there are thousands. I mean, I don't even know how many thousands of cover videos there are now. And at the time, I don't know if they're still up, but there were versions in French and German and Italian and Mandarin Chinese. And like, I mean, it was, there were animated versions. Like, people were just going nuts over the song, and it was just wild. And the story of, just before we get off the whole, like, universe,
sure,
wonders of the universe aspect of the story, the strangest part was, or not strange, I guess, because I agree with you. There are no accidents, you know, but I think that one of the most interesting and fascinating and exciting aspects of this story is that, so I became friends and friends with a number of the people who were working at YouTube, because it was a pretty small company at the time. And there were sort of these 6 million people that had started the company with Chad and Steve. One of them I'm still pretty good friends with, and another I talk to from time to time. But this woman named Mary Rose, she and I were emailing back and forth a lot at that time. So one day I asked her, finally, I was like, can you tell me, like, how did that happen that day? You know, how did you guys find my video? And she forwarded me an email from Chad Hurley, the one that I was staring at in the magazine, at 10:30 in the morning, which is when I was sitting on the plane looking at his face and having those thoughts. And he had literally written, it was like, hey, Mary Rose, I stumbled upon this video. I think it's pretty cool. You know, maybe we should feature it. And she said, you know, then she watched it a couple times and just put it up on the front page. And that just blew my mind completely.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's the part that I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, like, if that were in a movie, I'd be like, oh, come on.
Right.
You know?
cheesy. No.
Yeah,
well, you know,
like,
my brother used to tell me when we were younger, because he also agrees with there's no accidents, there's no coincidences,
yeah,
but he had a feeling that the universe would give inspiration to not just one person, but more than one person of the same idea. So it's almost like if the universe needs something to happen, then it will send out a signal to several people, almost like an insurance policy. And then knowing that one of them will do something with it, because he said that was his explanation for when, if you had an idea and then you saw someone else do it, then it's almost as if, well, they're the ones that did something with it, you're the one that didn't do anything with it.
Totally. Yeah. And you see that even with movies. Sometimes I thought, oh, well, I wonder if somebody shops a movie around and then people just take the idea and they make it. Cause I can't remember specifically which one I'm thinking of, but I remember a couple times being like, why are there two movies about this coming out at the same time? Or why are there, like, why is there a TV? And sometimes it's because someone's been influenced, but I think also sometimes it's just exactly what you were saying, you know, what your brother said, where an idea kind of bubbles up in the collective consciousness or subconscious or whatever it is that we're feeling that we don't necessarily register on a moment by moment basis. And a couple people have the same idea in different places. And I think that's happened even like throughout history with scientific discoveries.
Right. It is interesting. That more than one scientist is working on the same project, even though they may not be familiar with each other's work.
And in different parts of the world, you know, different parts of the world, people who've never met each other and before the internet, you know, before it was like constant communication that this was happening. And so I think definitely.
Well, and I think it makes sense when you talk about your songs and some of your songs being so easy to write. And it's almost like that connection there. No wonder, especially with your first song, that so many people were making covers of it, because it connected with them. So it's you know, to me, again, that's not a coincidence that you had people all over the world needing to express their version of it because it touched them so much.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, it was a message that needed to be heard at the time. And it was, you know, and it's so funny because so often now, I have new music coming out, and I've taken quite a long break from making music over the last few years. And finally, I'm, you know, getting ready to put myself back out there with this new album. And I'm sort of like, well, how do I make people hear it? You know, and it's like, you can't. You just have to, it's what you were saying. It's like, you can't try to control things too intensely because it's like a, it's pressure, and it's just, it's such an interesting thing because it's like just being unattached to outcome, you know, is so hard. And I feel like that's the work of my life, is how to be passionate about something and how to not expect anything from it. How do you have a goal? And I find it so confusing, you know, because it's like, well, and it's not necessarily confusing. Like, I understand the concept. If you want something too much and you hold on to it too tightly, it's like you just create so much pressure around it, and like you can't have it, you know. Right. It's like you create too much pressure on the idea, and like, but so it's like, okay, well, have your goals and then become super passionate about doing them, and then become completely detached from any expectations of outcome. And it's so hard.
Let me ask about that, because as a wiser woman, but I'm thinking of your two phases of music where you talk about how you took a break. So here you are, the 20 something that is, like you said, feeling like your life is over because of the frustrations in the beginning. And here you are, someone who's been successful and who is, you know, writing new music and going out again. What is the difference between these two women? Mentally, emotionally, like what, and the way you approach it, like you said, the way you're approaching this new phase.
You know, I think about it all the time, because I think having experienced a really unexpectedly huge moment in my career, having felt what that felt like and the momentum that just took over, and how, you know, it was so surreal. And so I think about that. It's like, well, how did that happen? You know, how did I end up playing in front of 80,000 people, you know, at Wembley Stadium? How did all of this happen? You know, I often think also, it's interesting because I think about this all the time, because especially in the arts, but in every career, and especially if you're a woman, people put a deadline on sort of like, well, if it doesn't happen by this time, it's not going to happen, and you need to shift your course. You need to give up, you need to change, you know, whatever. It's not going to happen.
Right.
And I feel like there's this expectation, and I think that the age maybe varies depending on what field you're in, but I just feel like it's always that way, mostly for women. And I think about it all the time, and I'm like, okay, well, so what is the difference? Why do people feel like you can't, if you get past a certain point in your evolution, in your life, in your growth as a human, like, why do they think you can't do something? And honestly, I think like one of the biggest differences, first of all, I think that's complete. Can I say?
Yes, you can say whatever word you want
to
say.
Oh, good. Okay. So complete bullshit.
Right.
Like complete and utter bullshit. But that is the collect, that like, that is what's in our consciousness. And so that perpetuates itself, you know, and that's one of the things that I really like. That's part of what drives me to put new music out and make my career bigger than it ever has been, because I just want to change that, like the ageism and like misogyny that goes together with ageism. I mean, it is so bad, and especially in the entertainment industry. And it's just really, it breaks my heart, because I know personally as an artist, I'm writing better songs. I'm a better performer. I'm a better person. I'm like, I have so much more to give now than I did when I was in my 20s.
Right.
Like the last 10 years have been really intense. And more than 10 years, it's been 11, you know, almost 12 years since this happened. And so, oh, actually, it has been 12 years.
You're like, oh my God,
2006.
Time flies.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, nope, it's not 10, it's not 11, it's actually 12. Yeah, so 12 years, it's like, you know, that's like a lot of growth. And that decade plus is a very formative time. And like, I can't even, you know, fully discuss at this very moment like how different of a person I am and how much better, you know, I am in so many ways. Back to the point, I really think that a lot of what happens is that when we're younger, we haven't had the series of failures, you know, like everything kind of seems wide open. We haven't experienced putting ourselves out, you know, doing this thing and being rejected or having it fall apart or having it not go right. It's just sort of like, I'm going to try this. Now, when I go out there, you know, when I put myself out there, yes, on one hand, I have an experience, a tangible experience of what that kind of success feels like. So in some ways, I'm almost in a better position than I was to create it, because I know what it feels like and I can focus on that. But I also have all the feelings of and the tangible experiences of what it feels like when it all goes really wrong, mm-hmm. and all the loss and the grief and the, you know, and the crushed dreams that happen, you know, when things don't go right. And so I think those things build up, and it doesn't have to be that dramatic. I mean, in some people it's just a bunch of things that didn't turn out the way you wanted them to turn out, or like several rejections, and like, but you have this other real tangible actual experience that is equally, or probably in most cases, more powerful than the idea of success. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I really think that's one of the things, is that that rejection builds up, and we lose belief in ourselves, mm-hmm. as time goes by, and we don't see the results we want to see. And then it's like, okay, well, I can't do anything.
For women, and I've said this on the show before, and Tara, you tell me what you think. All right. So Tara Naomi's on the show, and she's going to hear my theory and see what she thinks. I have said that I feel like men tend to have, they get a chance to deal with all that sooner than women do. And that's in the form of dating. So whether tradition holds true or not, my theory is that because men are forced as young as 14 years old to ask a girl to go steady with them, and that he has to deal with the fear, and he has to deal with the competition, because if he doesn't ask the girl, then one of his buddies might. And that he starts that at 14, and then he learns, you know, he learns whether or not he's going to be the man who decides to take the challenges as a challenge and to become more creative in a way to get a woman to go out with him, or if he's going to be the guy that's going to sit home on the weekends and not do anything. So all those emotions come forth. And then when he's in the work world, he gets mentors who teach him how to do all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that women are taught as young as 14, whether we do it or not, we're conditioned to believe that we're supposed to wait on someone else to ask us out, and wait on someone else to propose to us, and wait on, you know. And so whether or not it's something, I mean, like, it's obviously not meant to be something that is to be oppressive, but I do think subtly we as women have to be perfect in order for someone to come around and ask us out. So we have to look our best and be our best. So to your point of when we're adults, if things don't go perfectly for us, then we feel a failure because we're supposed to be perfect. We're supposed to be, and if we do what we're supposed to do, then some music executive is going to come up and get us. Some, you know, Hollywood exec is going to come up and take, some CEO is going to come and give us that promotion. Like, we have in our minds that someone else is responsible for our happiness instead of us having to find a way to make it happen. What do you think, Tara?
I think that's definitely true. And I think it's shifting, because with the generations now, it's like, I see there's just so much more room for being human now in everything. And like, my friends who are millennials and my friends who are, you know, in their early 20s and mid 20s and like, and even late 20s at this point, it's like they have a different understanding of themselves. And I think they're much more gentle with themselves and more nurturing with themselves and each other. Like, the competition factor that was there when I was coming up in music is between women, pretty much, it's less. Like, they're more supportive of each other. And I love it. It is a shift from that place where we must be perfect at all times, so that, you know, the most basic training that we receive as women early on, if we're raised in a very sort of traditional American household. I think it holds true. That probably is true for the majority of women out there in the world.
At a certain age, I mean, obviously, I'm hoping it's a certain age, because like I said, I just at least talk about it so that younger women and people like my son, I don't want my son to feel like he's the burden and has to make everything happen. I want him to be with women if he wants to be with women.
Yeah.
To where there's a true partnership there, where it's not, you know, not everything's on his shoulders. Because, you know, the problem with all that, too, is that it puts a burden on men, too, that is unfair in a certain way as well. So, like you said, if we're just humans and we interact with each other and we embrace each other and help each other, because if you have the confidence to want to help somebody else, then you're both successful. Because I think the people who don't want to help somebody else, they're the insecure ones.
Definitely. And you find that you find a multiple thing. I'm thinking of in the entertainment industry, often the nastier people are the ones who don't have the success. And sometimes the more relaxed, kind of potentially more helpful people already are the ones that are that are successful, but then that's kind of not true because a lot of times those people are so wrapped up in what they're doing and that's how they got to that place that they don't really care about helping anybody else. But there's kind of both types of people, but it is usually the insecure ones that are the nastiest. But I think also, like, just to your point about women, and I mean, I definitely think that's shifting, but that dynamic certainly exists in everything. I mean, men have been in control of everything, and there's this whole dynamic. And, you know, when I was coming up in the music industry, it was always about, oh, well, I have to get the approval of these men that are in charge of determining whether I am going to be successful or not. And it was mm-hmm. always men. I mean, yeah, there were some female executives. Of course there are female executives. It was such a patriarchal feeling. It wasn't at all nurturing and, you know, supportive and let's come together to make this work. It was all, am I impressing these people or not? Do they think I'm valuable or not? Do they see? And I really do think it's different now. Just even 10 years later, it's so different now. And I see it. I mean, I see women, like, when I go play shows, sometimes I'll see, in my case, when I moved out to LA in 2004, I was in pretty good shape physically. I worked out every day, and I got out there, and, like, the first thing that the producer told me was, like, you need to go to the gym more, you know? And I think I was like 5'4" and I weighed 125 pounds, mm-hmm. you know? I wasn't huge by any stretch of the imagination, but I felt like I was. And it wasn't only that I felt like it, but people were reinforcing the idea that I wasn't attractive enough and I wasn't right. thin enough and I wasn't, you know, and now it's like I go and there's just so much more acceptance, which I just love. It's like there's women on stage that are all different sizes and, mm-hmm. you know, all different looks and, you know, and it's not, obviously marketing is still the most important thing in entertainment, but there's room for more types of people now.
Maybe it's because I'm a lesbian. So maybe because I have an emotional, not only physical look when I look at women, but I know guys mm-hmm. who are the same way. And yes, you have this idea that somebody has to be a certain size, but you can tell a difference between, I don't know, getting even let's use the stereotypical slim females. Not every one of them are attractive. That doesn't even work. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I don't mean physically. I mean, I don't mean like facially. I'm just saying that they look uncomfortable. You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, as a person. Yeah, yes. Yeah, totally.
So people who have a certain vibe, I don't know how to describe it, but I don't care what shape they are. It's almost like this energy is
totally.
Far more powerful totally. Than just this cookie cutter idea of you have to be a certain shape.
Absolutely. And I think that's always been true to some extent. It's just what you believe. For me, I believed and it was reinforced by the people I was surrounding myself with that I was just not good enough in a whole slew of different ways. Mm-hmm. And so that actually is the most surprising. I think that's actually most surprising of all that I managed to achieve anything, given how, I mean, that's the biggest change between me now and me then. You know, when you said, what's the difference between those two women? I still struggle with believing in myself on a daily basis. And, but at least now I'm like aware of it and I'm mm-hmm. aware of the programming and I'm aware of, you know, the stories that are going around in my head about my own worthiness and whether I think I'm, you know, deserving of this or that or whatever, whether I think I'm, you know, I mean, when I signed a big record deal with Universal Music and Island Records. And I mean, the whole time I didn't believe in myself at all. I was like, wow, I can't believe they're signing me. I felt like a piece of shit. You know, I just was so, my self-esteem was always so low. And I, knowing that now, I can't believe I even achieved what I achieved, you
right.
know,
uh-huh.
because it's like, oh my God, that's so much of the work that I do on a daily basis to try and reprogram my brain to stop telling myself that I'm not worthy of things, because I know I can say intellectually, I know that I'm really talented and I know that my music reaches people and makes people feel something on a really intense level. And I know that when I get up on stage now, more so than 10 years ago, now when I get up on stage and play music for people, I know the power that I have to give them something, you mm-hmm. know, I know I'm really talented and I'm really good at expressing things that connect with people's hearts and like make them feel things. And technically I'm really like, I know these things intellectually,
right.
but it's such a struggle to actually feel them, to actually believe like, yes, you are worthy of walking up on a stage in front of a whole bunch of people and sharing with them. Like what you have to share is valuable and worthy of being shared. Like mm-hmm. it just seems so basic, but I think there's a lot of people who are performers and artists who are constantly questioning themselves and don't actually believe in themselves at all. And that's why you see all these insecure people doing stupid things. But, you know,
right. Well, I also think too, like in the radio industry, which has been my realm for so long,
mm-hmm.
that radio people off of the air, and I'm generalizing, but you spend your career, if you're in talk radio, kind of doing commentary on the world. And a lot of times it's critical commentary, but that's what makes the mm-hmm. best radio personalities entertaining, is when they come strong with opinions on the world. But when mm-hmm. they, and that's your strength, but there's almost like a double-edged sword with any of these talents, because the ability to do that off air, sometimes they're very critical people in general, whether of themselves or other people. So it's almost like, you know, mm-hmm. they don't leave it on the mic. And I'm sure the same mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the music. When you're on the stage, you have to be so vulnerable in order to make
yeah.
music that connects with other people, that when you're off stage, it's no wonder that you are having to channel these emotions, because it's those are the very emotions that make the strongest songs.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to be, you know, that I've always said that the music industry is such a dangerous place for people, for artists, because you're basically taking the most vulnerable, the most sensitive, the most sort of wide open people, artists, and you're monetizing this. And so you're crossing it with business people, which are purely about bottom line.
Right.
And so it just becomes so messy, because it's like, you are a product and that is how you are looked at. And that is, you know, you're rated internally as far as your performance commercially, like how things are going, or whether you're making money. Like people are looking at all the statistics and all, like as if you were a soda or like
right.
a car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no different. And so that, I think, is really a tough place to be in. And I know, like, when I signed my deals, I moved over, I signed in London. And so I moved over from the U.S. to London, and my manager was back here. And so I would go attend these meetings myself, which is really kind of unheard of. Like, you're not, the artist goes to some meetings. There's a lot of meetings that are supposed to take place without you in the room, because mm-hmm. then people can sort of speak freely.
Right.
And, you know, refer to you as a product and not feel inhibited or
well, and they
or,
can talk about, yeah, they can talk about the product like a car or a Coke,
yeah.
you know, like you're talking about it and the Coke is not going to get its feelings hurt if you're like, well, that can's a little
exactly.
dented. We need to do whatever, or the color
right.
is a little lackluster.
Right.
We need to repaint the can. But if the
right.
person's sitting in there, then they're going to get their feelings hurt.
Oh, yeah. I was in a lot of these conversations that were probably not great for me to be hearing.
Yeah. I would have crawled under the table and cried. So
it was strange. It was like, but then at the same time, it was, I'm so demanding on myself. It was like, no, you be a businesswoman. Now you go listen to this stuff and you don't get your feelings hurt. That was my attempt. But I think, and that just made me think again about what you said about boys at a really early age learning to deal with rejection. And I think mm-hmm. it's so interesting, because I have a friend, the same friend who used to tour with me, who texted me to tell me about Say It's Possible. She is now running, she's a venture capitalist now. She has a fund and she invests in all LGBT minority and women founders.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's so cool. And like a few years ago, she was homeless. It's an unbelievable story. But one of the things that she credits to her success, because she was raised in Mississippi and Texas, very poor, not the profile of 99.9% of people running venture funds.
Mm-hmm.
She's a woman, she's Black, and she's a lesbian. She refers to herself as a triple threat.
Right.
Which is hilarious, because it's like in the industry, that's, you know, she sings, she dances, she acts. She's
right.
a triple threat, you know. And so she's like, yep, I'm a triple threat. I'm Black, I'm a woman, and I'm gay, you know. And so it's very funny. But she attributes a lot of her success now and her tenacity to the fact that she was raised Jehovah's Witness. And she used to have to go knock on doors.
Right.
And she said, you know, and like one out of 100 of the doors she knocked on as a kid, maybe let her in. 99 out of 100 slammed the door in her face. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, from a very, very early age, got used to asking and asking and asking and asking and being rejected 99% of the time. And so now fast forward to today, and she was, you know, she's been rejected, I don't even know how many times, and she just keeps going. And now she's getting to the point where she's becoming very well known in the venture circles, and she's successful now. She's invested in 100 companies, and it's unbelievable. But she said, you know, it is that early training of being rejected and being okay with it. But I think mm-hmm. it's also a certain personality type too.
Everybody has their own, I don't know even how to put it. Each of us is different. Each of us has our own formula. So like you said, some of us aren't as sensitive as others, but there's always a balance of strengths and weaknesses, and everybody has to deal with their selves. And I think that yeah. is a lot of times on the show when I talk to women, one of the things I try to reiterate is to get to know yourself, because for a lot of women who have spent their lives letting everybody else run either their household, their career, whatever it is, mm-hmm. they don't know. Like if you ask them, well, what is it that you truly want? A lot of women couldn't answer that mm-hmm. question. By focusing on yourself and having to face, I mean, like for me, I'm in my 40s now, and I still mm-hmm. am having to face down demons that I've avoided my entire life. And I think yeah. that it's a scary prospect, but it also goes back to something you said, which is being more of an observer of what's going on in your head rather than a participant.
Yeah.
When you face it down and you realize it's not real, or at least you're watching it, it takes some of that fear's power away. It takes some of that negativity out of it. And I told a friend not too long ago that the things in my life that I've avoided facing, I've kind of almost made them into mythical proportions. Like I've made the fear so great mm-hmm. and the intimidation yeah. so great that it's become a myth. And what I have to do is realize it's not that big of a story. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. There's like, I know I've heard, I can't remember where, but I live in Los Angeles, so I hear a lot of spiritual talk and a lot of people with different theories and different sort of self-appointed life coaches and gurus and all. I've heard everything. But there was one thing that when you were saying that came into my head, which is like what you resist persists, you know?
Yes.
And that's the whole, you know, all the law of attraction stuff, manifestation. It's like, it's not like you sit there and go, I want a car, I want a car, I want a car, and then there's like a car in your garage. I mean, it's not that simple, and it's not that material. It is that simple in a sense of where you put your focus is what you're going to see.
Right.
You know, it's mm-hmm. like we can always find an argument. We can always find proof of what we choose to believe.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, it's like when you get when I got a Prius, and I got a red Prius, all of a sudden I looked on the street every time I was driving. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so many red Priuses.
Exactly,
you know?
Yes.
Like, So it's like, it's really true. It's when we sit there thinking about the thing that we don't want, the thing that we're afraid of, that thing becomes massive.
Yeah.
And we see it everywhere. We see proof of it everywhere, you know, mm-hmm. and people reflect it to us. They might be saying the exact same thing, but the thing that we pick up on is that thing that we're afraid that they're going to bring up, or the thing, you know, it's amazing how that works.
We're about to run out of time, Tara, but I do want to talk about, I know time flies, right? This has been awesome.
It flies. It went by so quickly.
But I do want to make sure that people in Atlanta, because I know a lot of the audience is in Atlanta, so I want them to know where they can come and hear you sing.
Oh, yes, please. Thank you. I'm going to play at Seven Stages on Sunday, August 26th. And it's an early show because it's a Sunday. So doors are at 6 and the show starts at 7. And it's going to be an intimate acoustic show. I don't even think we're going to use amplification. I think I'm just going to play acoustic guitar, and also I'll have a piano or a keyboard, something so I can play some piano songs. But it's going to be a really
kind of a special intimate show. And
it's a great space for an intimate show. If you've never been to Seven Stages, it's a great space.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
For those who are not in Atlanta, across the country, where can they find out more about you? Obviously, if they don't know you, which would be surprising, but if they want to hear...
Not surprising at all.
If they want to hear new music and know where you're going to be outside of Atlanta, where should they go?
My website, terranaomi.com, TerraNaomi.com. And I'm also on all the social media. So it's like Twitter at TerraNaomi and Instagram at TerraNaomi at, you know, the little at symbol. But probably, I'm sorry, I hear a symphony of dogs howling outside. I don't know if you hear that or not. But
they're giving you a standing ovation. They're giving you a standing ovation is what they're doing.
It was three or four different dog voices all howling. I'm like, really?
What are they trying to tell us?
I know. They're like, you're forgetting one of your social media sites. Don't forget to tell them about, you know. Yeah. And YouTube. I'm on YouTube. And I guess my official website is the place where you can find everything else.
Tara, thank you.
And Spotify.
Well, everywhere. Basically, what you're telling me is everywhere is that they can
find.
But Melissa Carter on Twitter, but unfortunately some other Melissa Carters got to Instagram and Facebook before I could. So I had to add the ATL after. Yeah. So it's Melissa Carter ATL. So it's just, you got Terra Naomi and you didn't have to alter it in any way because, obviously you're more famous than I am anyway.
Except for Facebook. Facebook suddenly rejected my Terra Naomi. It was facebook.com/TerraNaomi for like the last 10 years. And all of a sudden I got a notice I don't even know what happened. It's some glitch and you can't reach anyone at Facebook. So on Facebook, it's Terra Naomi Music.
Oh, so you did it. Well, what's hilarious is they probably thought you were trying to take your own name and that it wasn't you. You know what I'm saying?
It's just so weird though, because it was like, it was that way. I mean, it was a verified account and it had been that way for 10 years. So it's like all of a sudden something shifted. I don't know. It's probably like Russian bots or something like that.
Maybe. Well, Tara, thank you, honey, so much for taking the time to talk to us. Really appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you in Atlanta.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk to you.
Again, TerraNaomi.com is the website, whether you're in Atlanta or not, on where you can see her and get her new music and everything. And thank you, Tara, again, for being on the show. Well, we are out of time, and I would love for you to stay connected with us. ShePersistedShow.com is our website. And if you're looking for us on iTunes, you got to add the show at the end. So She Persisted Show, because obviously She Persisted, very popular phrase. One of the reasons we used it. She Persisted Show is what you're looking for online, iTunes. We'd love for you to catch up on episodes you may have missed. You can catch up with me on social media at Melissa Carter. Like I said, is my handle on Twitter, 1L2S's, and then Melissa Carter ATL is on Facebook and on Instagram. I'm not on Spotify, because I can't sing. So be sure and do something special for yourself. Like Tara and I talked about, I mean, every woman and every person, every human, doesn't mean that men don't have self-doubt. But with women, we just need to help uplift each other. Like I said at the beginning of the show, there's a lot of times we don't have anybody that's kind of telling us we're doing a good job and telling us that they see all the efforts we make and the sacrifices we make, and we don't get credit for them or we don't get accolades for them. So we got to do that for each other. And we got to do that for ourselves, most important. I mean, like I told Tara, I mean, there's things in my life lately I have had to deal with. And it's this same residual cycles of certain things in my personal life that have kind of popped up. I got to face them down. I got to face these demons down. I can't run away from the things that I'm insecure about anymore. I just can't. I'm a grown woman and I need to prove to myself that I am stronger than I'm giving myself credit for. And the same with you. You got to just face down those demons and they won't be demons anymore. You know what I mean? They kind of lose their myth, like I mentioned to Tara. And so be kind to yourself. Be good to yourself. Do something to make yourself smile and entertain yourself. And we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Say, this is Mr. Carter.
This is Mr. Carter.
And you're listening to?
Listen to?
My mom.
My mom.
On She Persisted.
Get from... Uh-oh.